whether or not you're talking about shipping traffic, the opening of the ice, there's a lot of national security interests.
The state's largest Alaska Native group wants a say in how the Arctic gets developed. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the military's newest stealth fighter makes an Alaska appearance.
Yeah, it was like going from a flip phone to an iPhone.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Alaska Senate President Pete Kelly says it will be challenging for the legislature to complete its work within the 121-day regular session limit. Items lawmakers must come to agreement on include the budget, changes to oil tax credit policy, and a plan for addressing Alaska's multi-billion dollar budget deficit. They also have yet to consider Governor Bill Walker's appointments to boards and key administration posts. The session is scheduled to end next Wednesday. Kelly says his preference would be to extend this session by another 10 days, which the Constitution allows with a two-thirds vote of both chambers. He says the Senate will not approve an income tax, a key element of the House majority's proposed fiscal plan. Kelly says he considers the tax bill dead. The Alaska Federation of Natives is keeping a close eye on the new administration of President Donald Trump. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports that the Bethel meeting of AFN's board was looking for ways to negotiate with the current government in Washington, participate in decision-making, and advance Alaska Native priorities.
Following President Trump's first 100 days, Alaska Federation of Natives President Julie Kitka is hopeful that Alaska can create a seat at the federal table. For example, Kitka sees an opportunity in a new task force chaired by Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue focusing on rural America.
And clearly, Alaska and much of the bush on that falls under rural America, so we're going to see whether or not there's opportunity to get some of our issues on the agenda with that task force.
She's also advocating for current bills that would allot land to Alaska Native veterans. While some people are nervous about the change in command, Kitka is taking it in stride. She's worked for AFN for more than 20 years, first as its lobbyist and then as its president. She has seen U.S. presidents and majority parties turn over multiple times. It's politics, and each change requires a different strategy for promoting Alaska Native priorities.
If you think about everything that you read about this administration, they don't like the terminology climate change. I think all our communications going forward should be on extreme weather.
Kitka was referring to how President Trump revoked an executive order passed by President Obama to create a Northern Bering Sea Resiliency Area with a tribal advisory committee. Alaska's congressional delegation supported Trump's action after the Bering Sea Elders Group had worked for it. For Kitka, the reversal is nothing new.
We're talking about how can people regroup, sit down and talk with our congressional delegation and the governor and see where we go from there?
Kitka says it's time to address the issue from another angle. Instead of approaching it from a natural resources and environmental standpoint, they could try national security.
Whether or not you're talking about shipping traffic, the opening of the ice, there's a lot of national security interests.
Kitka says the AFN board will be meeting with cabinet members traveling to Alaska to engage and educate them about Alaska Native issues. First up is Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who's traveling to Fairbanks this week to meet with representatives from other Arctic nations. AFN members will also be traveling to D.C. to lay out federal priorities and budget requests. Closer to home, Kitka says AFN is urging the Alaska legislature to pass a responsible fiscal plan.
Because it's our assessment, if they don't take action this year, it'll be very hard to take action next year because it's an election year and so many people are up for election.
Kitka was in Bethel last week for the AFN board's quarterly spring meeting. Each board member received a naloxone kit and a 5-minute training on how to use it. The kit holds a nasal spray that can reverse opioid overdoses. The members have taken the kits home to work with their communities to decide how to use this new tool as the state looks for ways to counter an epidemic of opioid abuse. Kitka also gave a preview of next fall's annual AFN convention. On the agenda are solutions to mitigate sexual assault, improve emergency preparedness, and merge declining federal and state resources to help the Office of Children's Services and the lives of children across Alaska. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
For the first time, F-35 fighter jets are flying in Alaska as part of a massive military training exercise. As Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, the small squadron is a preview of what's in store for the Air Force in Alaska.
More than a dozen reporters and military photographers gather on the tarmac at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson for a rare in-person glimpse of an F-35. The smooth, gray plane looks like a hybrid between a sports car and an electric razor with fins, stretching about the length of a tractor trailer.
You just can't get within 25 feet of it.
Officers from the Air Force and the Marine Corps are on hand to answer questions and introduce service members who are taking care of the new planes as part of the ongoing Northern Edge training exercise. That includes Major Adam Wellington, a Marine Corps pilot who first learned to fly the older F-18 Hornet, but has retrained on this new fifth-generation stealth fighter.
Yeah, it was like going from a flip phone to an iPhone.
The F-35 is the first plane designed for use across three different service branches, but each model is slightly different. The Marine version on display here can take off vertically, up and down like a helicopter. The 54 planes set to be released to Eielson by 2020 will belong to the Air Force. That model can't do the vertical landings, but has more space for fuel and weapons. The F-35 is the most expensive military program in Defense Department history, with costs projected to exceed well over $1 trillion. The procurement and development processes have been riddled with problems, and for almost two decades have been the subject of criticism by politicians on both sides of the aisle, all the way up to the president. The latest report on the planes from the Government Accountability Office in April found testing could be as much as a year behind schedule, delaying both the rollout timelines and production targets. Wellington says that as the first branch to get fully operational F-35 squadrons, the Marines are on hand to help share with the Navy and Air Force what the jets are capable of.
We're really trying to showcase what this plane can do to other units so that they can get kind of an education on we can help them out and, you know, vice versa if need be, but really integrating ourselves into the plans and the tactics, techniques, and procedures that are out there.
This is only the second time F-35s have been in the state. The first was in January when a small number were transiting through. None of the jets is set to be based in Anchorage. The two squadrons are forecast to bring around 3,500 service members, families, and contractors, but only to the Fairbanks area. Northern Edge wraps up on Friday. In Anchorage, I'm Zechariah Hughes.
Nearly $10 million allocated to the Army Corps of Engineers will pay for work to ensure the integrity of the Chena Flood Control Project in North Pole. Project manager Tim Favel says additional relief wells will be installed along the 7-mile-long earthen dam to protect it from groundwater seepage during high water events.
Those are the black pipes that you see on the downstream side of the dam. There's about 160 of them in place right now, and what those do is they relieve that uplift pressure from the groundwater associated with a high pool level.
Favel says water that comes out of the relief wells is channeled back to the Chena River. He says drilling of the new wells will get underway this summer in areas showing signs of seepage under the dam.
Like you might see some small sand boils or something like that where it might be percolating underneath. That's the place to install relief wells. And so far it's been minor, and we want to keep ahead of it.
The Chena Flood Control Project, completed in 1980, is designed to protect Fairbanks from high water events like the 1967 flood that inundated the community 50 years ago. $9.7 million for Chena Flood Control Project maintenance and operations is included in an omnibus appropriations bill that passed the U.S. Senate last week. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Green Up is here, but how does it vary from year to year?
It can vary quite a bit. It can be as early as, say, April 26th and as late as May 26th.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Anchorage Petroleum Wives Club has been around longer than Alaska's been a state. Founded after the first big oil discovery in Alaska, its purpose was to welcome the wives of the oil workers flooding into the state. But a lot has changed since then, so the Anchorage Petroleum Wives Club recently decided it's time to rebrand. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Harbaugh has the story.
On a recent Wednesday at the Lakefront Hotel in Anchorage, a few dozen women are gathered for a working lunch.
This right here is our ballot.
Really, a voting lunch. Anchorage Petroleum Wives Club President Linnea Ward greets the women from behind a small cardboard ballot box.
Here in the ballot box? That would be great.
All right.
Thanks.
As it turns out, it's a historic vote. After nearly 60 years as the Petroleum Wives Club, the members decide unanimously to update the name.
Our membership, it has voted to change our name to the Anchorage Petroleum Women's Association, effective June 1st.
Ward says there are several reasons for the rebranding. One is that petroleum wives might paint a misleading picture in some people's minds.
I don't know if this was true, but supposedly the gossip throughout the organization was that we were approached by some reality show wanting to talk about, you know, they do the desperate housewives of Orange County or whatever. And so there was an interest in doing some wives thing of, you know, Anchorage. And that's just not us.
The Petroleum Wives want you to know they're not a group of cocktail sipping, pearl wearing socialites, although some do get together once in a while for a ladies' night out. Take Ward, for example. Her husband may work for Conoco, but she's a PhD. This spring, Ward earned her doctorate in public communication and technology. Ward actually wrote her dissertation on the Petroleum Wives. She theorizes the group changed its name because the petroleum industry has changed. Ward says she's one of a growing number of club members who work too.
We're not all these super wealthy, just trying to throw money out there, or we're trying to destroy the earth one step at a time. We're just trying to make our way in this world. We're trying to give back. We're trying to find meaning.
In addition to getting together for activities like hiking, playing cards, and making crafts, the Petroleum Wives also spend time volunteering and raising money for local charities. But increasingly, the meetups have to be scheduled around the 9-to-5 workday. Ward says another reason the club changed its name is to welcome a new kind of member.
My name is Anna Belanger. I'm a petroleum geologist for Glacier Oil and Gas.
There are lots more women working in Alaska's oil industry than when the club first started in the 1950s. The Petroleum Wives recently changed its rules to allow oil industry workers to become president or vice president of the club. Belanger says replacing wives with women in the name means a lot to her.
I thought, well, my husband is actually a fisherman, sport fishing on the Kenai River. He's not in the oil industry. Am I able to join the organization?
The group connects Belanger with people across the oil industry. Belanger says she also appreciates meeting other women who understand the industry's ups and downs. After oil prices crashed in 2015, many companies announced mass layoffs. Member Zoe Smith's husband was retired from BP by then, but she says during the downturn, Petroleum Wives came together to help each other cope.
Especially the older ladies like myself, we've been through these cycles before, and it just gives support that maybe you don't find with your neighbor because they don't really understand.
The Petroleum Wives kept meeting throughout the tough times, even after losing about 80 members, close to a third of its membership. Today, they're still going strong. In early April, about a dozen members got together to make Easter goodie bags for a homeless youth shelter in Anchorage.
I found these today. They're actual bunnies.
cute, eh? Holly Lee organized the get-together. Lee's husband, an oil industry engineer, was transferred from Canada to Alaska in 2012. It's pretty common for oil companies to move employees every few years. Lee says finding friends in Anchorage wasn't easy at first. But then she joined the Petroleum Wives Club.
We are often, many of us, out of our own country. We're away from our family, like so many people who live in Alaska. And so this group provides a connectivity that I desperately needed.
Lee says some might argue the Petroleum Wives should have changed their name years ago. But she says for some of the members, the name represented a long tradition of women forging close friendships over their shared connection to the oil industry. And in that way, the Anchorage Petroleum Women's Association hasn't forgotten its roots. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Anchorage officials are hoping to keep emergency homeless shelters open longer past the winter months and into the summer. The change affects about 100 beds that are currently part of the city's cold weather shelter plan and would normally disappear during the warmer months. Half the beds are in the downtown soup kitchen, the other half in Beans Cafe. In a memorandum introduced this week to the Anchorage Assembly, the city's homeless services coordinator, Nancy Burke, says the measure would keep vulnerable residents close to social and medical services clustered around the downtown facilities. Burke says when people disperse from the shelters in the summer, it causes an uptick in unlawful camping as well as health and safety concerns. Over the past year, that included a fatal strain of strep and high rates of tuberculosis among homeless people in Anchorage. The effort fits with an expanding strategy by the Berkowitz administration to confront homelessness by pushing for closer coordination among municipal and charity organizations, as well as consolidating more services around downtown. There's also been intensified efforts over the last year to evict people from outdoor camps across the city's greenbelt. The ordinance will be open for public comment in the weeks ahead. A new community partnership is freeing up hospital resources in the Anchorage area by providing people without homes a place to heal. Brother Francis Shelter is working with the city's three main hospitals to provide respite care for sick or injured people who are homeless. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has more.
During her 26 years as a home health care provider, nurse Deb Seidel has treated people living in homeless camps and out of campers anywhere she could consistently find them. But she says healing on the streets is hard.
To be sick or to be just not well, maybe it's an injury, and to be on the streets is scary. It's difficult to heal. There's so much to try to pull together.
Wounds are more easily infected without running water, and overcoming an illness is harder without someplace to sleep all day. She says this causes people to go in and out of the hospital, taking up beds and using emergency department services. They need one simple thing.
For healing, housing is often that first prescription.
So a couple of years ago, a team at Providence began looking for a community partner that could provide short-term respite housing for people who are homeless. They found it with Catholic Social Services.
Here we are in the Brother Francis Shelter Medical Respite Area.
BFS Program Director Lisa Caldera walks into a quiet hallway at the back of the shelter with five double occupancy bedrooms, a small common room with large plastic rocking chairs, a kitchen, and an office for a case manager.
It is meant to be a space for peace and calm and healing.
The pilot respite program started with just two beds in October 2016, then quickly grew to four. Some of the 18 patient guests who stayed there received in-home health services, like nurses who changed bandages on wounds or physical therapists. Others just had a space to rest while getting over pneumonia or a broken bone. Caldera says during the pilot phase, Providence donated care to patients, giving the partners time to figure out details like visiting protocols and compliance with Medicare requirements.
We were able to practice and make mistakes and figure out how could medical respite work here at the shelter and for Anchorage.
Now, the respite area is officially open and has space for 10 patient guests, like Ed McLaughlin. He sits in the main hallway of the shelter chatting with friends. He joined the respite program because of a broken knee.
If it wasn't for back there, my only other options would be sprawl out on the floor out here like the general population does that's staying here, or be out in the streets.
McLaughlin says because he's had time and space to heal, he may not need surgery. He hopes to be back doing seasonal jobs soon and not returning to the shelter. For Vicky Hanna, the new respite program offers hope. She moved to Anchorage from Seward to seek medical care, but can't afford housing. And without housing, she can't get the surgery she needs.
The doctors don't like to do surgery for people who are homeless. So I was going to have to wait until I was, you know, until Alaska Housing put me in a place. But now I might be able to have it done sooner.
But Hannah can't pre-book a room in the respite area. Patients are connected to the program through the hospitals who contact the shelter, and together they see if the program is a good fit. The patient guests have to be able to care for themselves and be willing to share space. For people who stay longer than a week or so, the case manager will connect them to longer-term services and rapid rehousing. 14 of the 18 patient guests who participated in the pilot respite program did not return to homelessness. The program is based on similar models at homeless shelters in Washington and California.
Probably doing this has been the highlight of my career.
That's Deb Seidel again with Providence In-Home Services.
Part of it is to be in the room with community leaders and hospital leaders that all have a common goal and all have the communities and community members' best interest at heart.
She and others say this is the first time they can remember Providence, Alaska Regional Hospital, and the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium collaborating on a project. Construction companies and architects volunteered time to redo the space at the shelter. They're also opening a clinic at Brother Francis. Seidel says anecdotal evidence shows that emergency department visits are down since starting the program, but they don't have hard data. However, she has heard one concrete response from participants.
It is so good to feel safe.
In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Snake Watch 2017 is officially over. A 17-foot albino Burmese python is back at home in Meadow Lakes after going missing for 2 weeks. The snake, named Sam, escaped while his owner was doing some spring cleaning. The 100-pound python's disappearance prompted the Matsu Bureau to issue a safety advisory warning pet owners and parents to keep an eye on their dogs, cats, and kids. But the python event apparently did no harm on his excursion, and eventually he slithered back home to his owner, David Hyde.
I was thrilled. Immediately started petting him and told him it was good to see him and headed him for the bathtub.
And that's where the snake was yesterday, a yellow and white coil getting clean and digesting a rabbit Hyde had fed it. Hyde says he's happy to have his snake home, and he is going to be much more careful about making sure his doors are closed.
He was a rescue animal. You know, after 6 or 7 or 8 years, you kind of get used to having him around.
Animal control has no plans to issue a ticket for the incident. The Aleutic Museum is seeking a site to bury ancestral remains that returned to the Kodiak Archipelago this year. Archaeologists in the 1960s removed the remains from a grave site on Chirikoff Island and took them out of state. The majority of the remains ended up at the Indiana University in Bloomington. That's where they stayed until the Aleutic Museum was finally able to reclaim them. The repatriation process is now complete. Last week, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service signed over legal control of the remains to the Shunack tribe. Burial is the next step. Tonight, the City Council will consider the museum's request to create an Aleutic Memorial Park where the community can rebury repatriated remains. Aleutic Museum staff has pinpointed an undeveloped city-owned parcel behind the museum for the park. Executive Director April Lactinen, counselor, says the memorial itself would be at the center of the property.
For practical purposes, we're probably going to do something simple and natural, maybe a circle of stones, maybe some other sort of arrangement we haven't really decided. So there would be some trails going through it. There already are a few trails that pedestrians will take to cut across that lot, and we're hoping to preserve those.
According to a timeline in the meeting packet, the staff thinks it could begin landscaping next winter. Trees and shrubs are turning green across much of Alaska. But Fairbanks is the only community in the state that has an historical record tracking the green-up date. The official definition of green-up? Birch and aspen leaves open just enough to produce a faint but distinct green flush through the forest canopy. Alaska's Energy Desk is checking in with climatologist Brian Bretschneider each week as part of the segment Ask a Climatologist. Bretschneider told editor Annie Feit the official green-up date for Fairbanks this year was yesterday, May 8th.
And they look at the same ridgeline, and they look at the same direction, and they have the same methodology every year. So it's a really consistent record that now stretches over four decades, and that's not replicated anywhere else in the state.
And is May 8th typical?
May 8th is almost right on schedule. So May 9th is the long-term average, and it's been earlier than normal for the last couple of years, but the trend line is heading back toward that average date. But it can vary quite a bit. It can be as early as, say, April 26th and as late as May 26th. So a 30-day period. But again, we're right on schedule this year.
And why should we care about when green-up happens?
Well, apart from, just the way it changes the look of the landscape, it actually has some important climate considerations. Most notably, once the leaves come out, then they can actually transpire moisture to the atmosphere. So the amount of moisture available in the atmosphere for precipitation really goes up dramatically once those birch and aspen trees are fully leafed out. Also, if you're an allergy sufferer, the pollen from the birch and the aspen follows quickly behind leaf out. So Fairbanks actually has some of the worst birch pollen anywhere in the entire world. And last year actually was a record. But there's some other considerations on what makes a really bad pollen season. But that being said, it's going to follow pretty close behind when leaf out occurs.
And even though you don't have records for the rest of the state, can we say anything about green up in the rest of Alaska?
Well, it's highly dependent on temperatures. And starting in about late April, the interior becomes the warmest part of the state. So they're actually warming up faster than, say, we are here in Anchorage or in Juneau and other parts of the state. So it does vary based on exposure, aspect, and a few other considerations. But generally, it's going to occur in the central part of the state before most other places.
Brian Bretschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. Finally tonight, we have a correction in a story we aired yesterday about a proposal to make permanent fund dividends part of the Alaska Constitution. We mischaracterized the effect of legislation proposed by the Senate Resources Committee. The bill would reduce the future tax liability of oil and gas companies, but it would also eliminate tax credits. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Elizabeth Harbaugh, Zachariah Hughes, Ann Hillman and Annie Feit, and Casey Grove in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.